A content warning. This series deals with dark themes, including child and domestic abuse, sexual assault, and content that is inappropriate for children. Please be advised.
We'll press the lemon and the pride will cast aside our lives. We will be together until the end of time.
I remember Dad saying he's going to New Zealand to do this intervention. And would I be okay with coming along?
I told her what happened. I told her the whole thing. She couldn't eat, couldn't sleep for like 2-3 days. Throwing up, sick of her stomach, but she was like a mother to her, you know.
It was such a shock between what I believed and what the reality was. It kind of split my mind, shattered my mind.
I'm Tim Elliott. You're listening to Inside the Tribe. This is episode 6, Divine Forgiveness. It's summer 2007 in Rio de Janeiro. It's the opening ceremony of the Pan American Games at the Macarena Stadium. There to manage the catering is a 37-year-old 12 Tribes member named Yadutan and his wife Amuna. Yadutan, whose real name is Paulo da Silva, is a logistical expert. But tonight, he can't seem to focus. His mind is somewhere else. For years, he's been carrying a secret, and the weight of it is beginning to crush him. Paulo is tall and good-looking, with a warm smile and deep olive skin. He was born and grew up in Fortaleza, on the east coast of Brazil. In early 1991, he was working there as a computer technician when he met an American man named Robert Brooks. Brooks, who called himself Nahaliel, said he was in town to start a local community for a church group called the 12 Tribes. Paulo listened with interest as Nahaliel explained what the tribes were all about.
You know, it's people living together, working together. For a young guy, it looked very attractive. I started working at a very young age and ended up making a lot of money very soon, and kind of lost a few friends through different, you know, some got drug problems, some got shot. So I was going through a time when I met the community where I was pretty desperate trying to find something.
Paulo soon joined and was assigned a new name, Yadutan. His first job was to set up the books and establish relationships with local suppliers. He also registered Tribal Trading Brazil, the company under which the community would run its Brazilian businesses. The plan was to eventually move south, where the tribes would set up a commune just outside of the agricultural town of Londrina. To help them along, the 12 Tribes leader, Yonek, and his wife, Harmek, were joining them.
Well, I do remember the first impression, because I went to pick them up at the airport. And for a group that considers to have like a selfless life, he was very concerned about his appearance. He always looking at himself in the mirror, you know, like he's all... And I was like, wow, that's strange. We're not even encouraged to use mirrors in a group, you know? And he was always like checking his clothes and I thought that's a little bit shallow. You know, I mean, I'm sure you want to tie yourself up when you meet a group of people, but it's a little bit over the board. And that was my first impression. She was more like a lively person, you know, bubbly. She's all excited, like a little girl arriving in a new country, you know, that's my recollection. She always had like a bubbly, kind of almost like a childish way of being.
Harmek was also very friendly, especially to Yadutan.
She was always like grabbing my waist. Every time she's going to cross the road, she's holding my hand. Like, come on, she's a grown-up woman. She's at the time, she was like 44, 48. And she's like holding on to this young 21-year-old boy by the waist and, you know, crossing roads and just like very physical and really bothered me because... So I went actually to the leader of the group Nahalio. And I said, you know, I'm having a hard time because she's very physical with me. She's always touching me. She's always grabbing me. She's like putting her hands on me. You know, I'm a man. I have feelings. I was in a community without a woman for almost a year. And you have this pretty, she was very pretty, you know, long blonde hair, you know, just like very fit. So I was encouraged to not think about it. You know, this is how the way she is. This is how I am. She's like your mother. Don't worry about it. No, everything is going to be okay. You're just thinking too much. Don't, you know, same thing. Don't judge your elders. Or she would do openly. Like it was very natural for her to be this way. It was like her way of being. But if other women behave like this in a group, she would be corrected. But because it was her, she was allowed to do so.
Together with some other new members, Yonek, Hamek, and Yadutan took to the road in a bus, gathering supplies for the new commune. They would sometimes drive for days, sleeping in shifts.
One night, as I was sleeping, I was really dead asleep. By accident, I stretched my hand and touched her. I don't remember. She told me. I don't remember happening. She said I was just moving around in my sleep and I touched her. But the way she told me that, it felt a little bit like she was trying to connect in one way. It wasn't like she was just trying to say something happened. So I'm sorry. You know, like, well, holy cow. You know, what did I do? You know, I'm sorry. I didn't mean this. No, it's okay. No worry. No problem. And then I think it was the next night. When I went to sleep, she put her hand under the blankets with Yonek sitting by her side, laying, you know, sleeping in the middle of the night. She sneaks her hand under the blanket and holds my hand. I froze. I was paralyzed. I pretended that I was asleep. And I didn't want to think about it.
A few nights later, they were driving along the coast when the bus broke down.
So we ended up breaking down in the middle of a deserted beach. There's no houses around. There's a few places to camp. And, you know, I was fixing, well, we actually blew up one of the pistons. And we had to, you know, make a cover. We couldn't tow the truck. It was too heavy. So anyway, I was covered in oil. Like I have oil in my back and my chest. It's house black. It's like someone dumped a bucket of oil over me. And I said, well, I'm going to wash up. You know, go to the ocean, get some soap. And she said, oh, I'll come and help you. And but she said this in front of the two elders in the group, her husband. So anyway, she started helping me remove the oil and wash up. And then she gave me a hug. I mean, first of all, we're in the water. Like I was facing the ocean. I didn't want to be looking back at her because, you know, her breasts would be showing because her clothes would be like stuck to her body. And I was like on purpose, just looking, you know, a little bit scared, afraid of this whole situation. And then she gives me a hug, but not a hug like you hug your brother and sister, like a woman hugs a man, you know. So I could feel her whole breast against my back. Like she really gave me a tight squeeze. And that was the beginning. That's the when the whole thing really, really got going.
By early 1992, the group was busy building its deli and farm outside Londrina. Then, bizarrely, Yonek began sending his wife and Yadutan on errands in the van, even on overnight trips. It was unheard of. Single men in the tribes were barely allowed to talk to women. Now Yadutan was being sent out alone with Hamek, a woman 20 years his senior, who just happened to be married to the Anointed One.
And that what made the whole thing a little confusing for me, because it's almost like he was setting her up to fall. You know, I was going with his blessings on these trips, and we already had like a situation going, you know, like we had an attraction going on, physical relationship going on. And every time, it'll be very rare for someone to come with us. Unless they have to go do something or they have some appointment, they'll come with us. But usually I was always sent out alone by him, by the other elders, to go on trips with her.
But it,
it wasn't like I was just sent one time. I was sent many, many times over. And that created jealousy amongst the other single brothers. Why not send another guy together with me? Another single brother. It had solved the problem. So easy, right? Well, let's send someone else to help him. Or let's send some other lady, a single lady to support her. It would avoid any room for anything to happen. Even if he wasn't the apostle or the community leader, no husband in his sound mind would allow that. So I think she had something on him.
Before long, Harmek and Yadutan had gone well beyond holding hands.
We had everything else besides full intercourse. You know, she always would, you know, read things from the Bible, talk about Bible verses, read some stories from the Bible and some teaching about something. And then we had this whole physical thing going on. So my brain was scrambled. Like, I couldn't figure it out what was up, what was down. I was totally lost. And she had her claws on me, pretty much. I was under influence.
A year later, in 1993, Yonek and Harmek went back to America. The affair was now over. But Yadutan was consumed with guilt.
So after 2 months, I wrote her a long letter. I said, you know, what we did was wrong. I didn't join the group to live with this stuff in my conscience. The story in the Bible about David, when he committed a sin, he threw himself at the altar, you know, threw his life in God's hand. So I was pretty much ready for that. Either to be expulsed, sent away forever, have to go through some hard discipline. I said, I don't care what's going to happen to me. I just don't want to live here with this in my conscience. And I said, you need to bring this up. We need to expose the situation. When she got the letter, I think she called me the next day. And she said for me not to think too much, that she's going to talk to the elders, and then she's going to send me a letter. So I waited maybe a week or 10 days, 15 days later. I got a letter from her saying that the brothers met, and because our hearts are good, and we never had full intercourse. Because we didn't have full intercourse, our father was able to forgive us. And also in Proverbs says it's better to conceal a matter than expose, bring something to light. So for sake of discretion, it was better for me never mention this to anyone else. At the time, international phone calls would be super expensive. Every Sunday she'll call me. Every Sunday she'll call me. And, you know, people start to like have this, why is she always calling Yadutan? You know, why is she calling him all the time? And not just call me, but regular basis, almost every week, I'll get like a shoe box with gifts, you know, shoes or shirts. And then sometimes she'd send me things to give to other people, but she always made sure I always got stuff. And I was always getting presents from her.
Yadutan had become an important figure for the 12 tribes in Brazil. Every asset, including properties and businesses, was in his name. But to cement his status, it was important that he get married. He recalls the leadership in Hidden Night flying out potential brides from the States. In the end, he fell for a young woman who was already living in the Londrina community. Her name was Jessica, or Amuna, as she was known in the tribes. Amuna was the daughter of an American couple who had come to Brazil from the US with Nahaliel and his family in the early 1990s. Amuna had taught Yadutan English. They soon became friends and then fell in love. They married in 1998 and in 2000 had a son, the first of 3 children they would have together. The family was based in Brazil, but Yadutan was often invited to visit and work in communities around the world, where he became one of the tribe's most respected and loyal members.
At that time, I already had visited all had communities in Australia, had been to the community in France, Spain, Germany, Canada. I've been I've been pretty much almost all the communities in the U.S., and I was always invited to elders' meetings. You know, I was like a almost like a Yannick and Heimek's errand boy. I was the spy, and I was going on to check on things and see if things are okay and report back to them. They always say, tell me what you saw, tell me what's going on here, you know, report back to us. And everyone respected me that way. They knew that I was being sent by them. And I, you know, I worked in all kinds of industry, construction, soap shop. I was doing, besides having that kind of a place, I work as a normal community member. So people really took a liking to me because I didn't just sit, you know, sit behind a desk and read books the whole day.
In 2007, he and Amuna were put in charge of the tribe's catering operation at the Pan American Games in Rio. From the community in Londrina to Rio was about a 12-hour drive. For the game's duration then, he and Amuna were given permission to stay in an apartment in Rio owned by Yadutan's father. Amuna's sister also came to stay.
People would come from the community. We were selling granola bars from the community in the meals for the athletes and stuff. And so they would come to like bring a shipment and help for the weekend. And then they would go back. And then someone else would come the next weekend or, you know, during the week whenever we needed more.
At the same time, Yadutan was working closely with the game's organizing committee and was being increasingly exposed to a life outside the tribes.
I finally had time to see and think what it was like working with other group. They're non-religious. And actually, these people treated me a lot better than the people in the community, you know? They're kind, they're supportive, they're just willing to help. It's no bickering. Like, in the community, there's a lot of backstabbing and people talking about people's backs and power struggles.
It was a turning point. Yadutan was starting to see things more clearly, to gain some perspective. He thought back to his affair with Heimek and the guilt he'd been carrying around ever since. Why did he still feel so shitty about it? It hadn't been his fault. There was no reason to keep it all inside anymore. And so one night, after having dinner with some members of the games committee, he decided to come clean and tell his wife everything that had happened between him and Heimek.
When we got back, everyone was sleeping, and we continued to talk for a while, but I was just, like, so... I was truly a believer at the time. Like, I believed in everything. I wasn't in the mindset of thinking that things were that wrong there. So this information, like, started to kind of... It just kind of pulled the foundation out from under me, like, I couldn't eat. I think my sister thought I was pregnant because I was like throwing up and, you know, she was there for like those first few days. And then she had, I think she already had her flight before that. Like it was already, they had already bought her ticket home. So then she's like leaving me and the kids and I'm throwing up. And then I was going to have to face her again there and still not really be able to talk about what was going on because I couldn't even tell people back home, you know.
She couldn't eat, couldn't sleep for like 2-3 days. Throwing up, sick of her stomach, because she was like a mother to her, you know. And then we decided to send her an email.
Yadutan decided to confront Heimek in an email, asking if she had ever told anyone about their affair. The next day, he received a reply.
Our father does not want us to dwell on the past, but press forward to lay hold of what he saved us for. I know I am still a long way from that, and so are you, but we only have hope in him. When I have talked with Yonek about all the hard times I went through in the past, he did not want me to get into all the specifics. I've had many long talks with Yonek about all the hard times I went through many years ago. I told him that I had become very over-dependent upon you, allowing myself to divide from him and judge him in many ways for things that I judged were not right.
Yadutan replied,
it seems to me that someone needs to know in depth what happened to us. It seems like we need to be judged by someone. Maybe you have described the details of everything to Yonek and he forgave you and me. I need to know these things clearly.
Heimek responded.
Yonek told me to write to you to tell you that I have totally talked to him, something that I have never done before. It has been a long and difficult talk. Yonek saw at the end of it all my heart to want to follow our master, and yours also. He said he feels he can forgive. He hopes that you can come over soon, and he can talk personally with you.
They tried everything. They tried really to persuade, first, for us not to tell anyone, and second, to stay. I mean, very strange. Yeah, the fact they're pretty much trying to, I mean, they're going to fly us over to U.S., the whole family, without anyone knowing why we're going there. And I was the person responsible for all the business and everything else. And I was one of the leaders in a group. It was very like a hush, hush, you know, let's cover this up quickly, kill it as soon as we can. She lied to me in 93 when she told me that the situation was dealt with. And she kept this lie for many years. And we have things like Yom Kippur, we have judgment times, we have times that we have to repent to each other, ask for each other's forgiveness, and, you know, breaking of bread, you know, like all this very religious, sacred moments. And she was able to live with that lie for all these years. That tells me something about her.
I feel like they've always had a double standard, depending on who the person was. I think it was just really clear in that situation, but I don't think it was the first time. I mean, actually, I know it's not the first time. Like, there's been people that have been sent away for 7 years, couldn't talk to their wife or kids because of a kiss, and other people that have molested children and been forgiven.
Hamek's hypocrisy made Yadutan think anew about everything else that he'd seen inside the tribes.
Husbands don't take care of wives. Wives don't take care of husbands. They neglect the kids. There's so many issues with the youth, and, you know, people abuse their kids. They beat them too hard. So everywhere, all the communities I've been, same problems.
Meanwhile, Hamek kept messaging Yadutan, trying to placate him. In all, she and some other elders sent Yadutan 73 emails and texts, imploring him to forget about the affair, to let the matter rest. They also turned on the charm, reminding Yadutan and Amuna just how loved they were and what an important place they held in the communities. Then, in October 2007, Yadutan and Amuna were summoned to Hidden Night for a meeting with the leadership.
Yonek called me to the room without Jessica, and he asked me a few questions. Did you guys have full intercourse? I said, no. Did you have oral sex? Yes. Do you do this? I said, yes. And then he, you know, got the Bible and started reading some verses and said, you know, I love my wife. I said, Yonek, I'm here first, despite the community as a man. Because although I was single and I was young, you're married. And as a man to man, I need to apologize to you. I need your forgiveness because I could have stopped it. I'm sure I could have done something. I didn't. Yeah, I was influenced and swayed by the group, you know, the all the religious mumbo jumbo, and they're very powerful people. They have like a strong claws on people's mind and soul. But still, I could have done something. I don't know exactly what or how, but I said I have to make this right. So I asked him for his forgiveness, and he said, well, I don't want to see my wife going to the lake of fire. I don't want to see you going to the lake of fire. You know, we just have prayed to our Father to forgive you both and cleanse you. In any other situation like this, it would have been a huge government meeting, judgments for days, you know, sitting in meetings, people digging through your life and exposing all your faults and sins and like getting a magnifying glass over your whole life and talk about all your problems. And it's like a mental torture. I was ready for that. I was ready to face the music. And that's why I asked her to expose the situation. So he talked to me, and I thought, well, maybe this is step one. You know, because at the time, there's a lot of elders there from different communities. I thought maybe they're there for also to judge me and her. But no, that was it. That was the whole meeting. He just forgave me, and he just was expecting me to raise hands and pray together, and his forgiveness was enough.
But it wasn't enough for Yadutan. He now wanted out for good.
So when Yonek got the hint that, you know, I was thinking about leaving, he pretty much offered me to, you know, you can help me solve all these problems. You got to work with me. You know, you can go to any country of your choosing. You can work in any industry. I was pretty much a bribe to shut up. When he offered me this, I told Jessica, I said, you know, I'm not staying. I'm not here to be a leader of the group or have power, status. I didn't join for this reason. You know, I joined because I really believed it. I can't just keep it quiet.
It was late 2007.
And then, like, we left in the middle of the night and then left my sister there again. And, ugh. Yeah, it was hard.
They went to Florida, where Amuna had family. Yadutan had been a big deal in the tribes. When he and his family left, people started to talk. Within weeks, news began circulating among the communities that Hamek had been having an affair behind Yonek's back. Despite the leadership's best efforts, the rumours gathered pace. Then, about 6 months after leaving, Yadutan was in Florida, working for a skincare and cosmetics company, when he met another former 12 Tribes member. The man, who doesn't want to be identified, had been with the group for 18 years and had also heard the rumours about Hamek.
So as we started working together, we ended up talking and he said, what really happened? When I told him, he said he was totally shocked. So he said, let's write a letter and send it to everyone. I said, I don't think I'm in that place yet myself to do this. But if you write it, I'll read it. I'll confirm that everything that's written, it's what happened. So he wrote it, gave it to me. I read it.
This letter is for the people who still care about the truth. For those who've been on the edge, even for those who haven't. It's a wake-up call to our friends in the 12 tribes. I understand that it's not pleasant or even dignified to have to read these things, but I don't know any other way of getting my point across. I have sat in many meetings judging people for doing less than what those two people participated in. I've seen families torn apart because of judgments that have come from Yonek over youth who've held hands or kissed.
He went on to describe the affair and how Hamek had escaped any punishment. It also detailed her duplicity, how she had lied to Yadutan about having told Yonek. Yadutan and the other former member then emailed the letter to everyone they knew in the tribes who had access to a computer.
You've got mail.
It was a bombshell. As the news came out, whole families began leaving the tribes. Bob and Judy Pardon remember suddenly having a lot of former members coming their way.
We were getting calls from people we never expected to get calls from.
Yeah, we were getting a lot of phone calls, and there were a lot of second generation who left.
Yeah, second generation.
That was a huge driver. But particularly when they had this meeting, because it was building kind of a head of steam within the leadership, and they had a meeting, and Spriggs essentially came out and said that his wife had been forgiven.
Lord, we knew how big this was going to be. Well, in our mind, we thought it was going to be. You know, we thought the whole community is going to fall apart over this.
We thought they were God. And it really messes up. Like, even though there was lots of other people in authority there or leaders or whatever, we didn't have that same kind of view or relationship with them where, like, she could look at someone and just make them, like, feel ashamed or horrible about themselves with a look.
After the letter, other stories began emerging, including one about Hamek, or Marsha, and a teenager in Boston.
I mean, they were connected thigh to hip.
Courtney recalls seeing the two of them.
Marsha had her arm around him and had her other arm on his thigh and whispering in his ear. I know I could tell he felt very awkward there in public, you know, because it was right on the road, the sidewalk in front of the house. I walked up and I was just like, this isn't right. I just had no peace about it. They said hi. Marsha brushed me off. So I went into the house and Gene's right there watching. I mean, we had these huge double doors and he was beside one just watching. So I unloaded on him saying, you know, I don't have peace about how she is being with him. It's causing him to stumble.
Jean didn't seem particularly worried.
And Jean said, well, why are you telling me? I said, well, you're her husband. Why aren't you out there telling her to stop it? And he said, well, you're troubled by it. You go and confront her before you talk to me. Okay. So I went back out and I told her the same thing. I just said, I told her how she's a stumbling block. No one else will be able to act like that. She was like, well, I'm just counseling him. And I was like, you can counsel him without being in his lap. She's like, well, you have no place to correct me. I was like, well, if this is the body of Messiah, then I am free to speak my heart to you. And I am concerned. And I cannot get past my concerns because I feel like what you're doing is wrong. And I finally said that Jean was watching and that he had sent me back out here. She sat up and put her hands in her lap and was like, oh, wow. She just totally backed off then a little bit, you know, and was like, well. And as soon as she got her hands off, that poor boy jumped up and said, I gotta go.
In 2008, two men reportedly came forward from Boston.
And actually, I know both of them now that she did it with. And they were like teenagers. I don't know if they actually had intercourse or actual penetration, but I think there was some like nakedness and heavy petty going on.
One member reportedly received a payout after raising allegations that he had had an affair with Harmek.
When he left, they actually bought him a house and gave him a car and, you know, for him to keep quiet. What they did to him was pretty much the same thing they're trying to do to me, trying to bribe me to, you know, I don't know if they did it first in hopes that he would come back because his whole family stayed. But I think he left alone first.
The revelations about Harmek had caused serious damage to the tribes in America. More than a dozen families had left. Those who remained decided to follow Yonek's lead. He had forgiven his wife, and they would do the same. Meanwhile, for Mark and Rose, back in Australia, the scandal was neither here nor there. They had their own problems to deal with. Mark and David had attempted to run away from the bakery in Sydney, but been brought back by Rose and Israel. Not surprisingly, their commitment was in question more than ever. David had also just turned 15, and the elders needed to know where his loyalty lay.
One day they decided to have this meeting, you know, saying, you know, hey, your son needs to be baptised. He has to make a decision whether he's going to be in a community or not. And at that time, he was with all the elders. He stood up and, excuse the French, he said, you can all get fucked. That's what happened. So they all, so that was it. So they said, we're going to send you away.
Once more, father and son were cut off. This time they were sent to an isolated property that the tribes owned near Bigga, 2.5 hours' drive from Picton. There they were put to work chopping firewood.
They were like, you know, site work sheds, two site work sheds put together with a roof over the top, and we had a fireplace. So we'd be cooking, we had a gas on it, but we'd sometimes cook in a fire.
And I was allowed to visit, also with our two other daughters. We visited from time to time on the weekend, and we would bring them fresh food because they didn't have a fridge. So we would bring them vegetables and sausages and meat and stuff like that just to eat within the next day because they didn't have a fridge.
Life at Bigga was Spartan, but Mark didn't mind. He had a lot of freedom and was spending all of his time with David.
It was a lovely farm, you know. It was a lot, quite free days for a lad especially. I let him drive trucks around, drive tractors, and he thought it was great, you know. And we were there for quite a while.
The property at Bigga was special for another reason. It was the same place he'd come 7 years before to bury his stillborn baby boy.
I knew the farm quite well. Even though it was 1,000 acres, me and my child, we knew everywhere around the farm, even 1,000 acres, where all the waterfalls were, where the cliffs were. I used to go and have a look to where his grave was just to find out, but I just couldn't find it, couldn't find the rock. I don't know if it was concealed by them or what.
Didn't have proper markings.
There was no markings, but the rock was taken away, and I sort of was in the same proximity. I remember looking and looking, and I go, where? I just can't tell. I know even the rock that was a big giant boulder thing that I put on it. It's like it wasn't there anymore.
As the weeks, then months, went by, Mark and David found themselves suspended in a bizarre kind of limbo. They were allowed to do farm work and make themselves useful, but any human connection to the rest of the tribes and any meaningful link to their family had been taken away.
We'd chop wood and build things there. That's all I'd do. I wouldn't do much. I wasn't driving. We were stuck, literally stuck there. So, because I says, look, I want to get my license back and should be driving. But then they thought, no, it's not a good idea because the authorities could track you. But, I mean, we're not criminals. It's just ridiculous, really.
Then, in September 2009, the elders brought Mark and David back to the farm at Picton, where they convened a meeting. The news wasn't good. It seemed the elders regarded David as beyond saving. They believed that no matter what they did, he would keep being disruptive, that he could never truly be brought back into the fold.
So they said, we're going to send you away. You can go back to New Zealand with your son. You're going to have to live with your son until your son's old enough that he can fend for himself. Then you can come back to the community.
I didn't have any money or anything. They just got us tickets.
Mark was met at the airport by Sean Penny, another Kiwi who he and Rose had met at the farm in Picton. Sean had since left the tribes and gone back to New Zealand.
He had a few $100 in his pocket at the airport. He gave me $200. I had literally nothing. No license, nothing. No money, just the clothes and a little bag. We arrived on the back doorstep of my mum's place.
Mark got some work fitting kitchens and borrowed a couple of grand from his family to buy a car.
I didn't even have a license, but I ended up getting an L plate license. But I had to wait 6 months, so like a kid, you know.
Before long, he began to see things more clearly. He and David suddenly had some autonomy. Mark began reacquainting himself with his old life, the things he loved, like music and the people he'd cared for. Everything he'd given up to join the tribes.
My cousin had a nursery in Auckland, and it was quite a large property. And my cousin knew I was a muso, so he arranged to have a drum kit there. One night we started jamming. I was a bit more myself. And normally you wouldn't play rock and roll and stuff like that. We were playing all rock and roll covers and stuff like that. My brother came around, and that night I just had a few drinks, and I actually got drunk. And then I just remember my cousin saying, hey, man, you're going to leave the cult, man. You can't stay there. And I made up my mind then.
It had been a long time coming, and the implications were huge. Mark had spent 13 years inside the tribes. He'd raised his children there and given the best of himself to the community. But in that moment, he could finally see a different way ahead. When Mark told David, he began crying with joy. But telling Rose would be more complicated. Mark decided it would be better to wait until they were face to face in New Zealand.
Noon rung me at some stage and asked me to go back. I said, so I can't go back. I've got my boy was 16 years old. I said, he's not ready for me to leave him just yet. And I just had got him some course or something, in mechanics or something like that. So she's like, I can't come back just yet. So I was waiting for Rose to come over.
Yeah, well, they had promised that I was going to see them. We were going to be able to see them in Auckland after maximum 2 months, they were told me. But it actually took 7 months for them to send us
But I was very discreet for all those months. If I said that straight away to Rose, I felt I could have lost Rose because she was, you know, you end up quite brainwashed because I thought that she could think, oh, hang on, he's all, he's going to leave, you know, he's going, you know, he's going to be fodder for the evil one, you know, for the devil, whatever. So I was a little bit more discreet regarding saying, you know, hey, I've left. I didn't tell her at all. I wanted to come over then explain to her that I'm leaving.
Finally, Rose flew to Auckland to see Mark, taking their two daughters with her. But they weren't the only ones going to New Zealand. Without telling Rose, Mark had organised for Matt and Tessa Klein to be there too. He would need their help in what came next.
So I remember Dad saying he's going to New Zealand to do this intervention, and would I be okay with coming along?
Tessa was only 14 at the time, just a girl. She didn't know it then, but her role in the operation was to prove absolutely critical.
I had so much adrenaline. We had to sit outside in the car for quite a while to wait for the right moment. If they leave and you stay, you won't see your family again.
You've been listening to Inside the Tribe, hosted by me, Tim Elliott. My co-writer and producer is Camille Bianchi, editing by Mark Wright of Term 6. This is a DM podcast production. We've also used some third-party TV and print material through the series, with details on those in the show notes. If you or anyone you know is affected by any of the subject matter raised in this episode, you can contact Lifeline for crisis support on 131114 if you're in Australia, or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline on 10273-TALK if you're in the US. Contact information for other services, including support to leave a high control group, can be found in the show notes.